The feast is o'er. Now brimming wine in lordly cup is seen to shine before each eager guest. And silence fills the crowded hall, as deep as when the herald's call thrills in the loyal breast.
Welcome back to the Weird Medieval Guys podcast. I'm Olivia, and this is Aaron. He's in disguise.
That's right. I feel like I need to address the elephant in the room here, which is that last week we made a whole song and dance about how isn't it problematic that white boys get a little bit of Islamic theology in them and kind of get a bit too into it and spend a lot of time misrepresenting and sort of projecting onto Islamic traditions. Anyway, that's not what we're going to do today.
That's right. Today we are talking all about one of the most fascinating, ideologically and theologically complex and incredibly compelling groups of people from medieval history, and that is the Order of the Assassins.
That's right, and they're exactly like the video games.
Oh, they do have a creed, that's for sure. Yeah. And we'll be getting into that.
They all wear coordinated outfits.
Exactly. And they all press B to stalk or whatever. I've only played like the first 10 minutes of one of the Assassin's Creed games. I'm sorry, I'm a fake Nizari Ismaili Shia fan. So the Order of the Assassins, the group of people who in fact gave us the word assassin, so prolific were their assassinations that they carried out, was a small, secluded, and somewhat secretive sect of Nizari Ismaili Shia Muslims that arose in the mountains of Persia in the 11th century AD. And that probably sounded like word salad to you, but hopefully by the end of this podcast episode, you will understand a little bit about what it means to be a member, what it meant to be a member of this group of people, why they came about, and why their worldview developed in this fantastically complex and extremely unique way.
Yeah, and they are so, I think one of the reasons why, because it is always fun when you get to become a verb. I think that's great. But they are one of the most confusing groups of people to have ever lived. And yet they are so kind of tied into the history of basically every aspect of the sort of late medieval history of the Islamic world. And it's going to be very fun. We're going to get to meet some fun characters. There's going to be lots of derring do and sort of, and there's some capers in the story.
Oh, there are lots and some of Mongols. Capers. Yes. Yes, exactly.
So before we get to the assassins, there's going to have to be quite a long run up, especially for our non-Muslim listeners who are, you'll be surprised to learn, at least a significant minority of our listenership. And I think Olivia gave you that very complicated, very qualified definition of Nizari Ismaili Shia Islam. And we're going to have to understand each individual word in that sentence, we're going to have to go all the way back to the very, very beginnings of Islam. And hopefully I'm going to be able to run through all of early Islamic history in less than 5 minutes. So let's see if I can land this particular plane without Olivia hitting me at any point. So Arabia, what is now, you know, mostly Saudi Arabia, but kind of all the Arabic speaking countries in the Persian Gulf, has been around for, you'll be surprised to learn, quite a long time. The Arabs are kind of noted by the Persians and the Romans, all the way back in antiquity, and they basically ignore them for most of the sort of antiquity, because Arabia is this kind of pretty unforgiving land of deserts and then these sort of great oasis cities like Mecca and Medina. Then in the early 7th century, an Arabic nobleman called Muhammad, you may have heard of him, begins preaching of revelations that he has received from God, specifically the Abrahamic God, which is a very important detail. So under Muhammad's leadership, his followers formed what is called the Ummah, which is the sort of the Muslim community, you might say. And the Ummah, led by Muhammad, manages to conquer pretty much all of the Arabian Peninsula by Muhammad's death in 632. However, when Muhammad dies, there is a succession crisis over who should sort of replace him as the spiritual and political head of the Muslim community. So the majority of Muhammad's followers supported Abu Bakr, but a minority of them backed Ali ibn Abi Talib, who was the Prophet's cousin and his son-in-law. The majority ruled, and Abu Bakr was elected caliph, so essentially the kind of political head of the Islamic world, as it was at the time. Now, this sort of pro-Ali versus pro-Abu Bakr split was primarily a kind of political and factional one that did not initially lead to a huge rupture in the community. I mean, there were a couple of caliphs after Abu Bakr, including Ali, who are called the rightly guided caliphs, because they're the ones that pretty much everybody agrees were rightly guided. they're the least controversial ones. But the split kind of remained within the sort of the inner circle of the Muslim political community. And in 680, Ali's son Husayn ibn Ali leads a revolt against the caliphate. Now, they are met by a vastly superior Muslim army outside of the town of Karbala in what is now Iraq, and Husayn and many of his followers are massacred. And the Battle of Karbala is an incredibly important moment in the history of Islam, much even more so than the sort of this dispute over Muhammad's succession, because the Prophet Muhammad's bloodline in Islam is an incredibly important source of legitimacy and also source of spiritual authority. And the decision to kill a member of the Prophet's family was seen as unforgivable by a lot of the Muslim community, mostly consisting of the people who had originally supported Ali to be the caliph back in the 630s. This leads to a split in Islam that has persisted to this day between, on the one hand, the sort of the pro-Ali faction, who are called Shias, and the originally pro-Abu Bakr faction, who are called the Sunnis. Now, I'm vastly oversimplifying the distinction between Sunnis and Shias. I don't want you to think this is primarily about a political succession in the 7th century, but that is just the point of the Battle of Karbala is the point of rupture from which things get interesting and more complicated. So, we've now established the Sunni versus Shia split. It's important to note that for pretty much all of the history of Islam, the vast majority of Muslims have been Sunni, not Shia. And that has had a couple of interesting impacts on the development of Shia Islam. There have been lots of Shia rulers over the history of the Islamic world, but generally speaking, the experience of being Shia has more often than not been that of being a besieged minority, especially outside of the areas like Persia that are more like that had a sort of disproportionately Shia populations. And that led to the development of a couple of kind of ideas within Shia jurisprudence. One of these is the idea of tahiyya, which is literally means prudence, and it's just essentially it's a concept that means you're allowed to lie about your religious faith if it sort of protects you. Which again, if you are a persecuted minority, that is a useful concept. Because another thing to remember about about Islam, especially medieval Islam, is that it's not... We've kind of talked in the past about how Muslim rulers tended to be more kind of conciliatory to religious minorities than Christian rulers were in the Middle Ages. This, I really need to make this very clear, this applies to Jews and Christians. If you are anything else, so if you are like the vast majority of of Persians before the Islamic conquest of Persia, you are Zoroastrian. If you are seen as an apostate from Islam, so you are, for example, members of the Baha'i faith, which is a kind of another religion that sees itself as Islamic but has not been seen as Islamic by other Islamic rulers throughout history, or if you are simply the wrong kind of Muslim, you can face pretty harsh discrimination is totally okay under the Sharia. So that all being said, let's make this sort of theological universe more complicated, because the Shia community did not remain united after the split from the Sunnis. Oh no, wait, hang on, there's another concept that I need to introduce.
What's
fuck
that?
Keep that in.
Okay.
Just keep this in, because I want people to know how hard I am working to keep this coherent. So the other concept that's really important to Shia Islam is the idea of the imams and the imanate. So iman is a term that is used in both Sunni and Shia Islam, but it is used very, very differently. In Sunni Islam, an imam is sort of a prayer leader. It's sort of, and I'm going to, this is not totally true, but I'm just going to use it as a shorthand, kind of equivalent to a Christian priest or a Jewish rabbi. In Shia Islam, imam means something very, very, very specific, which it means somebody, I'm going to get my definition right here. Essentially, an imam is an infallible spiritual leader.
And there's only one imam. Shias believe that there's only one imam at any given time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a chain of succession. And of course, we'll see that there are questions that arise over how this succession takes place. But essentially, for Sunni Muslims, they believe that it is the job of the community. You know, the imam is someone who is the conduit between the community and God. And the Sunni Muslims believe, the Shia Muslims believe that God has chosen Muhammad, who is the first imam, and God has chosen every imam after that, essentially.
Imams also, this is another important point, though. Muhammad was the first imam, but imam is not synonymous with prophet.
No. It is, again, a spiritual leader.
Yes.
A community spiritual leader. And
it's probably the closest we ever get to a quote-unquote Muslim pope.
Yeah. Yeah.
But even that is a comparison that is so broad.
In Shiism, yes. Not in, because what I was going to say was, because in Sunni Islam, you know, kind of coming up against these obvious questions of, well, then how does succession work and how do we determine the rules of succession? You know, it's seen as not actually being something that people could possibly have jurisdiction over, like answering these questions of who was defined by God to be the next imam. And so that's why in Sunni Islam, to give you a very simplified overview, the community chooses. Because it's like, well, we couldn't, it's not, you know, we couldn't say that God wants this guy or God wants that guy. You know, that's speaking on behalf of God. But anyways, carry on.
Yes. So now we're going to make things more, as I promised earlier, we're going to make things more complicated. Because not all Shias agree about how many imams there have been, or indeed whether or not there currently is an imam.
And again, this is why the Sunnis were like, actually, this is too complicated.
We're not doing this. So there are two traditions on the number of imams. These are the big traditions, I should say. There are about 1,000 other sects that you could pull up, either that exist now or have existed. So the majority of Shia Muslims in the Middle Ages and now are what are called Twelver Muslims. So, according to the Twelver tradition, there have been 12 imams, and the last of these, Muhammad al-Mahdi, is prophesied to have been occluded or hidden in some sort of cosmic way to return only at the end of days. The Twelvers are the vast majority of the Shia community, but there are lots of other sects. The largest of these other sects are Ismailis, so they split from the Twelvers over the succession of the sixth imam in the 8th century. And they believe the imanate has continued to be passed down through the male line of the sixth iman. And again, there are different Ishmaeli sects, as we will see, but in some traditions to the present day. So there is a minority of Shia Muslims who believe that there is a currently living imam, and he is out there. He's a real guy. You can look him up. He's called the Aga Khan.
You can shake his hand. Yes.
He seems pretty normal.
He owns a lot of horses.
So we're now three levels deep on this Russian doll of Muslim sects. But don't worry, we're not done yet. We are going to take a bit of a detour now to talk about the geopolitics of the Muslim world. So the focus of our story is going to start in the 11th century, and so it's useful to have an understanding of the political context in the Muslim world at the start of the 11th century. So one of the things to bear in mind when you're talking about sort of the medieval history of Islam is that in this period, the Islamic world is generally divided into these sort of large, slightly kind of clanking, contraption-y, multi-ethnic empires that are each kind of ruled by a dynasty that has something slightly weird about them. So it's usually, when you talk about sort of the Middle East in this period, you generally talk about sort of the dynasties that are ruling a given area rather than using sort of geographic terms like Egypt and Persia. Those were terms that were important, and they were important kind of cultural distinctions between Arabs and Turks and Persians and all the other different kinds of people who were living in the Muslim world. And those geographical sort of signifiers were still used, but you wouldn't, for example, be talking about, even if you're talking about an Egyptian sultan, you wouldn't generally say the Sultan of Egypt. So that, with all that sort of table setting, there are several large empires that we're going to have to keep track of in this story. So the first of these is the Fatimid Caliphate. So the Fatimids are a Shia Ismaili dynasty. They're descended from Ali. And they rule, broadly speaking, they rule North Africa and the Levant. So like what is now, you know, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Palestine, Israel. On the other end of the spectrum, modern-day Iran and Iraq are ruled by the Seljuk Empire. Now, the Seljuks are essentially a bunch of Turks who've come in and have been ruling Persia for a while. They are Sunni and Hanafi. You may remember the Hanafis from the previous episode. However, they are, over the course of the 12th century, they gradually kind of lose control over Iran, and they are supplanted by the Khwarizmid dynasty, who are a different Turkic dynasty, and they are also a Mamluk dynasty, which is, they're emancipated slaves. We can't, this is the problem with medieval Islam, is you see things that are so tempting to talk about. We can't get into the Mamluks. And also the Abbasids are there. The Abbasids, who were kind of the third caliphate after the Umayyads. They never really went away. They got kind of kicked out of Persia, but they're still clinging on to the area around Baghdad. And that's the geopolitics.
All right.
Oh, and the last thing to say is there are a lot of meanwhile in Europe, there are a lot of Christians who are getting quite excited about the idea of taking back the Holy Land.
Oh, yes.
This is of supreme relevance, is that the Crusades are about to happen.
So, let's open our tale in earnest with the story of a man named Hassan I Sabah. So he is living in the 11th century. He's a young man who is born in Persia to a Twelver Shia family. So the sort of mainline Shia family, Shia branch, the bigger branch, you know, the much more well-established one. But as an adolescent in Persia, he becomes very interested in and converts to Ismailism. And he travels all the way around in his 20s through all of the Muslim areas of the Near East, so through Azerbaijan and Iran and Armenia and Syria and Palestine, on this like circuitous trip to get to Cairo, which is the heart of the Fatimid caliphate, and it's the sort of ideological heart of his world now that he is converted in this way. And on the way, he's like going around and he's having conversations with people. He's sort of like trying to convert people. He's getting thrown out of places for being really argumentative. and in what survives of his writings, like, he describes himself as someone who has this unquenchable thirst for truth. And like, that's what's brought him to Ismailism, is this like complete disillusionment with the, like, you know, sort of a degeneracy, as he perceives it, of the rest of the Muslim world. You know, he sees people like drinking and being much less than ideal Muslims, and he is on this sort of personal and spiritual journey to reconnect with like what belief and faith really mean. Now, we don't have a lot of reliable information about the specifics of his life, especially this period, but we know that he does make it to Cairo eventually, and he stays there for some time amongst the other Ismailis in the caliphate. And this is like one part where scholars sort of disagree, but it's thought that he begins to become somewhat disillusioned with the Fatimid like state mechanism and the way that it's operating, and that this might have something to do with the fact that he can sense this sort of brewing like schism in the family of the caliph, because there is, as there often is, a scheming vizier. And although according to the
ding ding ding, you can that was your free square on bingo.
Yeah, there's always a scheming vizier, and oh well, actually there'll be other scheming viziers.
There's
later.
So many scheming viziers.
They love to scheme. And so Hasan is, it's believed, sort of, you know, catches wind of these schemes that are happening at court. Maybe he pisses some people off. He might have been put in prison and then released because of what was interpreted as a divine signal when the prison like collapsed. And then I think they try to deport him and like the boat sinks. And you know, he starts off his life and this spiritual journey as this guy who, you know, the way that his story has been passed down, he's like very fated to be this important guy, the fulcrum of a new ideological movement.
Which we always have to kind of treat with a little bit of a grain of salt.
Yes.
Because this is kind of coming to us in the form of hagiography.
Yes, very much so.
And so it's like how all medieval saints' lives are kind of like, and then mysterious things kept happening and everybody knew they were destined for greatness. And it's like, well, some of that was probably post-rationalization.
Yes, and the way that this guy is treated is very much, I think, comparable to how saints are treated. But either way, he's also has this belief, and this feels this strong call to what is, it's the Da'i, isn't it? The Muslim call to preach and proselytize and be a missionary. And that's one of his like life's works, is to be a missionary and spread the faith. So he leaves Cairo, possibly under slightly acrimonious circumstances, because he believes that a scheming vizier is trying to sow discord in the court and
probably is.
And oust the older son in the Ismaili. Oh yeah, sorry, I never actually picked up that.
Yeah,
thread.
You're gonna close the loop
yeah,
of the scheming
vizier.
I'm gonna
actually walk us back a bit. Right. And so in the Ismaili doctrine, it's believed that the imamate passes down through primogeniture, basically. So the oldest son of the imam will be the next imam. Pretty simple. And therefore, slightly distressing when it seems like there are some schemes in place to maybe oust Nizar, the oldest son of the caliph, who's also the imam of the Fatimids. Either way, we don't have to pick up on all of this now, but he's... You know, Hasan clearly is someone who feels like this compulsion to wander and to proselytize. There's a sort of Muslim obligation called Da'i that's the obligation basically to be a missionary and spread the faith. And so that's kind of what he does best. And he goes out again and he wanders all over the place.
Well, he's a man of faith who's been confronted with very grubby sort of material politics.
Exactly.
Interfering in what seems to be the most holy of all, and from his perspective is the most holy of all successions.
Yes, because again, there's one imam. The imam is like the, you know, the link between people and God, and the imams, you know, in Islam, there is no distinction made between religious and secular leadership. You know, there is no, like, divine right of kings. There's only the imam, who's the caliph. So there is only one guy who's in charge, and he is appointed by God. You know, it's like if the Pope was also the king.
Yeah.
And
well, as if that would ever happen.
And we all lived according to biblical law, you know. It's like that. And so the idea that these, like, petty court politics could be, like, trying to interfere with this. I mean, it's not the first or the last time it'll happen, but it's obviously quite, you know, disillusions a man such as himself. So he goes and he wanders. And he wanders through Seljuk-controlled territory. Again, he's probably starting some arguments, but he's also picking up a following because people kind of like what he's saying. And the Seljuks, who are the dominant power in a lot of the areas where he is preaching, are not super pleased that he's just going around undermining them like that. Because remember, they're Sunni, he's Shia. And, you know, they'll tolerate him a bit, but they start to kind of try to, like, stomp him out. And he actually retreats, like, further and further into the mountains in northern Persia. And it's believed that around the end of the 1080s, he and his followers come to this realization that they need to find somewhere where they can base their operations. They can't just be this itinerant movement forever. Right, like every group of homies needs a trap house, essentially. And they come upon such a place in the mountains in the north of what's now Iran, just sort of south of the banks of the Caspian Sea. A castle called Alamut Castle.
The gamers in the audience, I think, finally a name I recognize.
Is this in Ask Creed?
I think so.
Nice. And one of the ways that they have picked up popular support, Hassan and his followers, is by preaching specifically in these Seljuk areas, Seljuk-dominated areas, because the Seljuks sometimes, you know, you didn't hear this from me, but they can be a little bit heavy-handed with their, like, conquering techniques and tactics. There have always been Shia strongholds in these mountains. There have always been people that resisted these sort of, you know, external temporal changes. And so there is a fair bit of popular support for them. Nevertheless, they come upon this castle, and it is Alamut Castle. It is occupied by a local ruler who won't even get into who he is. Doesn't really matter. But they find this castle in 1088, and they occupy it. Hassan and his men occupy it in 1090, apparently. And apparently over the course of 2 years, between 1088 and 1090, they've staged a bloodless takeover of Alamut Castle. Not a single person has been killed. But suddenly, Hassan has been installed, and his men have been installed in this castle. So the stories of how this happens are really interesting.
My impression from what I read is that it's essentially the movie Parasite.
It is. Yes, it is. Actually, it is a lot like that. No, it is a lot like that. Well, there's different traditions. There's various stories. But essentially, all of them include an element of Hassan sending his men to the castle to preach. And, you know, he sends them, like, in small groups, and they start to, live among the denizens of this castle. They start to convert them to the Ismaili cause. They start to spread Hassan's ideology. Oftentimes, you know, this ends with Hassan then occupying the castle for himself. Often this includes a version where Hassan himself goes in disguise as a teacher and lives in the castle undercover for some extended period of time. Essentially, all of them end with the local warlord realizing that this has happened and trying to kick them out, but all of the residents of the castle have already been converted to Hassan's Ismaili cause. So Oh, and in most of the variations as well, Hasan actually pays the guy for the castle. So he says, I beat you fair and square, but, like, you know, I don't want to break the law, mate. So, like, you know, here's just under market value. In another variation as well, Hasan asks the guy to sell him as much land as he can fit under a cowhide. Or, you know, as can be covered by a cowhide, and the guy agrees, and then Hasan slices the cowhide into, like, strings and ties them together and wraps it around the castle and says, I want to buy this castle.
If you ever find yourself in a medieval Islamic parable and somebody offers you a unit, such a vaguely defined sort of unit of value, I want as much gold as you can fit, you know, grains of sand on a chessboard.
Yep, like, exactly.
Do not take the deal. Take the lump sum.
Someone says, I want as much, you know, grain as can fit in a thimble. And you say, sure. And then they pull out a giant thimble. There's always stuff like that.
Guess what, dickhead? You didn't think that I would build a thimble the size of the shard. Now pay up.
Exactly. And so this is in 1090 that this takes place again, and even better, in Muslim sort of numerology, we get told that the letters of Alamut yields, like, a number that is the same as the year in the Muslim calendar as when they took the castle. So we've got even more, you know, information about how this is all just, like, divinely meant to happen. So anyways, pretty exciting stuff. Suddenly they've got this castle. And I think it's worth, like, also stepping back and saying that, like, we are speaking and we are going to keep speaking of Ismailis and of Hasan. And Hasan is not, like, the leader of all the Ismailis. He's not even a leader of this small sect that's going to sort of break off, or this schismatic group that's going to break off. He's not even the only one who's, like, proselytizing in the mountains, but he's one... He and Alamut Castle are the most significant example and a representative example of broader trends in Muslim society at this time, broader Muslim society, of just there being a lot of fragmentation and there being a lot of splinter groups that are breaking off and a lot of people sort of doing their own thing. It's a very confusing time, and this is one of the dominant strains of confusing new ideology. But Hasan himself apparently stays in the castle for the rest of his life, and he never leaves. This is what the legends say. Again, somewhat unlikely. We get told he goes outside twice to go on the roof in the rest of his life, and otherwise just sequesters himself in there. Don't know if that's true, but he does do a lot of writing and a lot of development of his ideology, and he pioneers quite a few concepts that are going to become very, very relevant for the Assassins. So this is sort of seen as the beginning of the Assassins as a movement and as a society. And so in the beginning, this is sort of, it's quite exciting. It's a quite exciting development for Hasan and his men. No one is sure exactly how things are going to go. And at first, they're really just trying to lay low and, like, hang out, consolidate the resources, like, maybe do some local proselytizing, not do too much more proselytizing, like, get their farmland in order, get their gardens in order. We're going to return to the gardens and just become self-sufficient, essentially, because that is their plan, is to carry on the Ismaili mission by basing themselves in these hilltop fortresses and essentially just doing as much as they can to both preach to the locals and to do, like, subterfuge against the Seljuks. So, obviously there are some people that kick off a little bit. The local Seljuk emirs try to thwart Hasan and his people. They are thwarted themselves in a sort of series of tales that's described as being very clever. You know, they get outsmarted each time by this smaller, scrappier group of guys that live in the mountains. And so eventually they attract the attention of the Sultan himself, Sultan Malik Shah, who says, like, we need to do something about this. These guys are not making me look good.
Who will rid me of these meddlesome dudes.
Exactly. So what do you do when you need to get something done with, you know, get rid of some meddlesome guys? Who do you call?
Well, not the assassins, not yet, because no. They are the assassins. What do you do?
You call your scheming vizier.
Of course, the viziers.
So he calls his scheming vizier, Nizam al-Mulk, and he says, please do something about these guys. This is about 1092 that this is going on. And so Nizam al-Mulk begins to organize forces to, you know, conduct some kind of more coordinated effort, and he gets murdered very, very quickly. Intriguing.
Only there was a word for a high-profile political murder, but unfortunately we don't have one yet.
And not only does he get murdered, he gets murdered in a very strange fashion that is, again, slightly shrouded in mystery, because he's apparently being carried on his litter, as scheming viziers often are, between Isfahan and Baghdad. Which, like, long litter, you can see why Hazan wanted, like, to kill these guys. Like, he was like, I hate these guys so much. Why are you being carried on your litter? Hundreds of miles. And a man dressed as a Sufi ascetic, wandering sort of preacher, approaches the litter and stabs him and kills him.
Which is not a very Sufi thing to do.
No, no, it's not.
I think that guy might not have been a Sufi ascetic.
No. I mean, we actually don't know a lot about who this was. There have been theories that actually it was the Sultan himself who was not who stabbed him, but who coordinated this, dare I say it, assassination. There are, of course, Ismaili people have been held responsible for this. We don't actually even know what happened to the guy. It's not recorded, the murderer, whether he was captured or killed or escaped. But it's generally agreed that this was carried out by the Ismailis under the orders of Hassan.
Dun, dun, dun.
And
somebody call Claudia Winkleman.
And this also coincides with the... with the Sultan himself dying just a few weeks after that, for unrelated reasons. He wasn't vaxxed. This is unrelated, actually.
That's the only one of those jokes that you're getting.
Oh, a lot of people are going to get vaxxed in this episode.
It would literally be every 5 minutes.
Oh my god, yeah. And so this actually throws the Seljuks into chaos, because like all good empires, they have a really messy succession scheme. Essentially, the Seljuk Turks are not really loyal to, like, a Seljuk state. They're loyal to the Sultan. And while they're having a succession crisis, which, by the way, lasts, I think, like 13 years, mm-hmm. There's very little centralized power in the area that they previously controlled. And so this is the perfect time for the Ismailis to... continue to spread the word and to continue trying to carry out their mission.
And I think that's a really important point that is going to keep coming up, which is that the nature of power in the Seljuk state, and also the nature of power more broadly, kind of in these big, ponderous, multi-ethnic empires, where quite often the local ruler isn't even the same religion, doesn't speak the same language as a lot of the people that he's ruling. Actually, targeted assassinations are kind of the perfect scalpel to cause as much chaos as possible.
Yes, and so because of this lack of centralized power, the Ismailis are able to seize more and more castles and strongholds and win more and more groups over to them. And this often happens by subterfuge and by trickery rather than outright violence. And so outright violence, you know, traditional warfare will never be the name of the game for the these Ismailis.
Well, because they're just some guys in a castle.
Yes, so there's one where they sort of pretend to be like a Seljuk army and to be like show up to a castle and say, oh, we've been stationed here, like, let us in. And they take it over. There's another one where they apparently they do a lot of like scam, like old school scams, basically, like Nigerian prince scams, or just like asking people who they know who work there to like leave the back door open,
slip in the Zari. Yeah, that's exactly. Gonna make sense in 5 minutes.
Exactly. And also slowly we start to see other people getting murdered in mysterious circumstances who seem to all be connected to opposition against the Ismailis. And it's slower in the beginning, but there is very much an ideology being developed by Hasan and his followers about what their role is as Muslims and as Ismaili Shias in particular, because there's very much a Muslim precedent for this. So I want to just quote Marshall Hodgson, who wrote a really good book called The Secret Order of the Assassins about the history and the ideology of this movement. He says, a number of Muslim sects had already used assassination as a technique. So it's recorded of Muhammad himself that on several occasions he exclaimed that one or another inaccessible enemy of his did not deserve to live, and was then gratified by one of his men's finding ways of destroying the enemy in question. The purist Kharijites in early times, who declared all other Muslims apostate and therefore subject to the death penalty, sometimes showed their fervor by killing any individual Muslim in their path. We hear of the word jihad, holy war, being applied to individual killings with a religio-political purpose, first in connection with early Shiite groups. It is the jihad kafi, the secret struggle, which is parallels the public one on the frontiers. And then there's another extremist Shiite group called the Kunag, the Stranglers, for such was said to be their method of killing. But he says none of these groups, however, gave to assassination the major political role which it came to have at the hands of the Nizaris. So, yeah, this is not just about getting rid of people who pose a threat. It's about making a statement. And he says, by the end of the Nizari power at Alamut, the Fidais, those prepared to do the jobs of assassination, were possibly a distinct group of people. Maybe this evolved into like a separate subset of them. But in the beginning, it was this organization of basically everyone involved who was willing to do this kind of insane thing in order to further their cause. So Fidai is the term that's used to refer to the devotees of Hasan and subsequent leaders of this movement. And it's used in a way that sort of means foot soldier, but the literal definition is sacrifice. So essentially people willing to sacrifice themselves. Yes, and so the last sort of element to add to this ideological schism, what really formalizes it and allows Hasan to go from just being one weird Ismaili guy with a lot of his own opinions to really being at the head of a full-fledged movement is when the Fatimid Caliph dies and the older son is indeed deposed and the scheming vizier puts the younger son on the throne. Again, this is a huge violation of Ismaili principles and, of course, a completely unacceptable for Hasan and other purists of the movement. So it's, you know, basically broadly accepted by the people who are at court. And people who are sort of in Egypt and immediately surrounding Egypt, but like everyone else, every other Ismaili in this sort of scattered diaspora, if you will, is like, what the hell, man? And so that not only, you know, really cements the split between Hasan and the Fatimids, but it also gives him another source of authority and another way to drive people towards him. So now he's almost fighting a two-front war. One is against the Seljuks and one is against the Fatimids, who are now being ruled by an imposter.
Dun, dun, dun.
And so one of the concepts that Hasan introduces to his religious movement, which we can now call Nizari, because that is what they call themselves, essentially, because they believe Nizar, the older son, should not have been offed. Oh yeah, he also gets offed later on, because he tries to stage a rebellion. No one's happy about that. And so it's Hasan who introduces the idea of the hidden imamate and the visible imamate. So, right, this hasn't existed until before this. This hasn't existed before this, right? Having two imams.
Yes, having two imams.
That's new, yeah.
The Twelvers already think that there is a hidden imam.
Yes.
But that is a different guy.
Yeah, Hasan introduces this dual imamate that becomes a Nizari hallmark, that is the idea of a hidden imamate, which is being fulfilled by a visible imam. So there's a hidden imam who is, like, somewhere out there and you can't see him, but there is also a visible imam who's, like, that guy's lieutenant. And it's his job to basically just, like, do the work that the hidden imam would be doing. And so this is a really useful mechanism because, you know, without, you know, the imam is the person who's the conduit between people and God. And if you don't have that guy, then, like, you're completely up the creek without a paddle. You have no link to God. And because Nizar has been offed, there is no imam, but we need somebody, right? Like, you know, so it just so happens that maybe some guy who lives alone in the, you know, lives in a castle in the mountains and doesn't have much else to do could become someone who, you know, helps to bridge the gap between people and God. And he does not purport himself to be an imam in the traditional sense of being like a descendant of the imam or being chosen by God. But this begins this tradition of rulers who are acting as the imams, which of course, you know, there is essentially no difference in practice. Yeah, and so this begins this era of sort of the heyday of the assassins. So there's a lot of different words that these people use for themselves. So Ismailis call themselves, I think, Batiya, which means like initiates or like people with esoteric wisdom, basically. So yeah, there's a lot of different names that like focus around this idea of like, we are the initiates. We are the ones, the only ones that understand. We are people with the real knowledge of the imam and the real knowledge. You know, we are the only people with the guy who talks to the real imam who's invisible.
Who is off screen.
Who's off screen. But he's, you know, whispering cues from the left wing. And so, yeah, again, it all gets very esoteric and very obscure. And this becomes like a key part of the movement is that actually it is really impenetrable. And this is a big part of like the shift from missionary work that occurs to the, you know, the center of the movement being the Dai, the soldier. So, yeah, it's no longer just about talking to people because it's like, you know, we have secret wisdom. And, you know, we are kind of, we're actually like the stewards of this wisdom. So it's a big, it's the start of a big break from mainstream Islam, including other kinds of Shiism, because it's, you know, starting to like contradict what is otherwise like a completely uncontroversial obligations, like the obligation to preach and to spread the faith. So it's, yeah, very strange ways that this develops. But it heralds in this era of subterfuge and warfare, but covert warfare against the Fatimids and against the Seljuks. So they take more castles. They make attempts, the assassins, to spread into Syria. Unfortunately, as soon as sort of they make good grounds, like, you know, they make good progress, they'll get squashed back. I mean, they're still just a very small force in any kind of territorial battle, you know, head to head, without their sort of secret tactics, they're not going to do very well. And so they do very much survive on being covert and being agile and flexible and having this guerrilla warfare method. But yeah, they kill a lot of people, because unfortunately that's kind of the nature of this like absolutely insane power structure in this area at this time. You know, they'll make some advances while like the Seljuks are suffering a succession crisis, and then the Seljuks will decide on a guy, the assassins will get a couple castles taken off of them. It's a big back and forth, but actually in the 1090s they have loads and loads of assassinations. Again, mostly of Seljuks, but also of some Fatimids. And so sort of a circuitous way of reaching this point, but one of the many names by which they call themselves is, in Arabic, I believe it's like assassin, which mm-hmm. means like men of the word or men of the book. And again, is like a reference to their hidden esoteric knowledge.
But Olivia, I thought they were called that because they did lots of drugs.
Yes, and so this is part of this, like, mythology that forms around them. And I mean, I think probably lots of the assassinations that are attributed to them probably weren't actually carried out by them, but they become this mythical, larger-than-life group of people, you know, governed by this guy who doesn't leave the house, so nobody knows what he's like, and he has all these insane theological ideas. And obviously, like, they are not very well-respected or well-thought of. by the other Muslims. And so it's actually in, right. So it's in 1123, I believe, that the Fatimid Caliph, Al-Amir Biham Allah, writes about them, and he calls them not assassins or assayins, but hashishins, which means like hashish eaters.
Which generally so, like, also just means smokers. Yeah, low lives.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the connotation. It's like these guys, these are scum, essentially.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But a lot of people have kind of run with that as like that being what they called themselves. They did not call themselves hashishin.
No, and they absolutely, Hassan absolutely abhorred alcohol, and probably also by extension, my guess would be hashish. He actually, according to legend, executes his own son because his own son was accused of having a glass of wine or something. So, yeah, this isn't the kind of guy that would tolerate something like that. Funnily enough, the caliph who calls them hashashins actually goes on to get assassinated by them in 1130.
Heard you were talking shit.
I don't know if it's connected to him, to them, you know, being called pot smokers, but you never know. And so in the background as well, by the way, what's another important event that's been happening, just gonna set this up for later, is the Crusades. So we've had like one crusade happen already in the 1090s. This is mostly, the assassins have mostly been insulated from this. There's another crusade in the 1140s or something. So there's a lot going on in the world, and even, you know, bigger than the Muslim worlds as well. And even as the Seljuks begin to disintegrate, their empire loses a lot of its power and its stability over the course of the 12th century. It also just becomes clear to the assassins that they're living in this big, wide world that's moving quickly, and a small mountain sect is having to fight pretty hard to sort of just stay afloat. So there's something extremely interesting that happens that will be sort of pivotal for the assassins' ideology. And for Nizari Ismaili ideology that happens in 1164. And so this is that the leader of the assassins he declares the end of the world.
Ah. Now, I have some thoughts. Because you may have noticed that the world did not end in 1164. And it has continued to not end since then. But it's important to note that, like, in this context, the end of the world, the apocalypse, does not mean let's all drink the Kool-Aid.
No, it actually meant let's all drink the wine.
Huzzah!
Basically. So yes, it's the Kiyama is what it's called. And yes, in like mainstream Islam, Muslim theology, this is like the doomsday in the realist sense, in the essentially like revelation sense. But this was something completely different to the assassins. So their leader, whose name was also Hassan, actually, this is Hassan II. I mean, it's hard to know exactly like how to interpret this, but he basically tells his, you know, acting as the imam, the visible imam, he tells his followers, I have a message from the hidden imam. And he says it's the apocalypse and that we should prepare. And this has really specific ramifications for the Nizari Ismailis. And this does not mean that, you know, everything catches on fire or anything, but it means that they are living as if, you know, they are preparing for the end of the world all of a sudden. And it's a very strange time, and it's not without controversy. In fact, it's something that's deeply troubling to a lot of the movement and causes a lot of instability within the assassins and the Nizaris. But essentially, it's a complete turning away from Sharia, and it's a turning away from, in particular, the outside world. They are essentially, like, giving up on the world. And this is when the movement really solidifies as an esoteric movement. I mean, esoteric literally, like many of this group's other titles, means initiates. It means like inside the circle. And this is when they say, essentially, we don't want to proselytize anymore. We don't want to preach anymore. We are essentially like declaring, you know, from the hidden imam who gets it from Allah, declaring like Sharia law to be in its current form, you know, as is interpreted by the imams prior, to be over. And this isn't them saying no to God or to Muhammad or to the concept of Sharia law, but so much of Sharia law and of what, you know, is Muslims are obligated to do basically derives from like hadiths or from things that the Prophet himself did. And it's believed that those are things that we need to emulate while on this earthly plane. And if you're saying, well, we're not living like we're on the earthly plane anymore, well, maybe we'll still follow things that it says in the Quran we have to do. But actually in the Quran, it doesn't say you have to pray on you have to fast on Ramadan or you have to pray five times a day. It doesn't say in the Quran that you have to do that. Those are things that Muhammad did. And therefore, to be like him, we do those things. But they give up on those things.
And this is the point at which a lot of Muslims in the wider Muslim world go, these guys are not Muslims. What the fuck are you talking about?
Yes, and even today, I mean, people basically look at these guys the way that, like, you know, Catholics look at Mormons.
Yeah.
you know, as, like, this is, like, not even just, like, I mean, this is, like, they become worse than Christians or even Jews to a lot of Muslims.
They're apostates. Like, they're people who've abandoned the faith.
You know, people are saying, like, they're not even saying, oh, you guys have got, like, you know, you guys are worshiping the same God, but in the right way. This is when people start saying, like, oh, you guys are worshiping demons, like, you're evil. which you can understand because it's this complete shift. So yes, praying five times a day, still something that Nizari Ismaili Muslims don't do. But what is being replaced with is this belief that, you know, you are constantly in a state of prayer. And so, like, Ramadan, fasting on Ramadan is not something that you have to do because it shifts to this idea of you should always be existing in a state of self-control and abnegation. And you should always be withholding yourself from, you know, things that would give yourself pleasure. And so it's a very strange turn indeed, and it's punctuated or it's initiated or heralded in by a festival where they literally get together and ritually, like, break all of Sharia law. and so they, during Ramadan, they have a massive banquet in the middle of the day and drink wine and turn their backs towards Medina.
Oh my God.
And,
I will say, if I was a Muslim in the Middle Ages and I heard that this was going on, I would think that they were worshipping demons.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. But yeah, I think you have to interpret it because, you know, it's very theologically complex and, you know, everything, I mean, it all still makes my head spin, all of these ideas of, like, the hidden imam and the visible imam and, oh my God. But you have to interpret this not just as something that is, like, religiously motivated or something that is actually being caused by these people being crazy. You know, this is not just, oh, these people are crazy. If you look at it from the inside, then it is very clearly a way for Hassan II to square these conflicting ideas of, you know, we don't have an imam. And we don't have a way of really engaging with the outside world. And he needs a way to consolidate his authority. And he needs a way to consolidate people's obligation to him. And he basically needs to, like, you know, refuse these ideas, you know, or fuse back together these ideas that were split apart of the two imams by, you know, repositioning himself as the spiritual and the, you know, legal head of his religion.
Yeah, and remember, like, the Crusades are a very important context for all this, because it's like, the Christians could be here in, like, 5 weeks. Like, all of the kind of old certainties are falling apart. The political kind of, the political challenges to the Fatimids and to the Seljuks are also spiritual challenges. And reaffirming the kind of, not just kind of the your own doctrine, but your own kind of place within that doctrine as the head of this organization is very important.
Yes, and there are also a lot of different ideological threads from outside of Islam that are coming through, you know, the Middle East and the Near East, because there are a lot of Jews and Christians living around these areas, and they're also, you know, theologically and intellectually engaged with their communities, and there are strains of intellectualism that are bringing classical authors, so like Neoplatonism or Platonism has been described as being a big influence on this theology. So yeah, it's also very much influenced by Jewish and Christian apocalyptic thinking as well.
Which is massively on the upswing. Yes. At around about the same
which
time.
Which is having a huge uptick as well. So, yeah, again, incredibly complex theological question, but it is, yeah, it is reflective of a worldview and a political situation that basically requires this level of nihilism, basically. Mm-hmm. And again, this really re-emphasizes the imam in the Nizari conception as being like the main guy you care about, because until now all of Sharia law was decided by like the previous imams, but this is a break from the old world. We're putting the past behind us, you know, and so that's what allows them to be quite sort of flexible and dynamic with how they interpret all of these laws and which ones they keep and which ones they get rid of. So yeah, it's a new, somewhat cynical era. All of these things, again, coincide with bigger forces sort of threatening to choke out the assassins from their strongholds, especially in Syria, which has been the main place where they have focused on trying to make land claims and expand their territories. Actually, not that long after declaring it's the apocalypse, one of the assassins actually assassinates Hassan II.
I never thought this would happen to me!
because they think it's complete heresy, and it's, again, a very unstabilizing time for the movement. He does have a successor who's working under him to try to, and after him to try to sort of consolidate and keep up with things, but they start to lose a little bit of the lands that they have, a little bit of the progress they've made in places like Syria. And this is really good news for other people with designs on lands like Syria and, I don't know, maybe all of the Middle East.
The Christians have arrived.
Yeah.
So we're not going to do the entire history of the early Crusades, but the important thing to note is that almost 500 years after losing Syria to the early Radishan Caliphate, Rashidun Caliphate, the Christianity returns, and they set up a succession of sort of small principalities along the sort of the Levantine Mediterranean coastline, you know, Kingdom of Jerusalem, things of that nature. So this is obviously a huge blow to the Fatimids, who remember have been who were the local rulers, and this kicks off a bit of a political crisis, little tiny political crisis,
yeah,
in the Fatimid Caliphate, because they've lost Jerusalem.
Yep.
And the character who stands to take advantage of that is a military commander called Saladin.
Yes.
Who is just a Kurdish soldier.
Yeah. So initially, during the period of the Crusader States, the assassins try to strike a little bit of a deal with the king of Jerusalem, who is, you know, a Christian king, and try to basically make an alliance against some of the other Muslims who are encroaching upon both of their territories. So the assassins are like, well, they hate us and they hate you. They might even hate us more, but let's not talk about that.
Believe me, they definitely hate them more.
And that actually doesn't go that well for the assassins, because I believe they still get, like, ambushed, and a bunch of them get, like, ambushed and killed by some Christians anyways while they're trying to hash out the deal. It's, like, a complete disaster. But you've got this big baddie Saladin sort of on the horizon, and so even though, you know, the assassins and the Knights Templar and the Crusaders are, like, all really not happy to work together, and they're all quite suspicious of each other at this point, you've kind of got Saladin in the background, like, you know, snapping up all these bits of territory. and sort of, you know, everyone can sort of see where this is going. Especially because once the first king that the guy, that the crusaders, or that the assassins try to work with, dies, the next one, I think, is 13 years old and he has leprosy.
Oh my god, not, what's his face?
Yeah, Baldwin.
Yes.
Yeah, poor Baldwin. And I think Syria is also being run by, like, an 11-year-old. At this point, so it's like a totally great time to be a Kurdish guy who wants to rule the world. Yeah, so obviously Saladin is a ideological and political enemy of the assassins, so what's the right thing to do? They try to assassinate him, and there's like a great series of accounts of them trying to assassinate him where they like almost get him.
It's very Fidel Castro and the CIA.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah.
Poisoned pens.
It's really funny. You know, there's all these ones that are like, oh, they like, you know, cut a hole in his tent and then like, you know, go in and there's like a note on his pillow that says like, you thought you got me. Stuff like that. Or, you know, they'll throw a knife at him and it will like, you know, lodge itself in the wall an inch from his head and he'll be like, these guys aren't so bad. Yeah. And this is like the heyday of when a lot of the like assassination sort of like legends, and again it's all like very, very mired in myth, but it's the heyday when we get a lot of these really good legends. So there's like, you know, I think there's also legends about them, like, leaving notes in, you know, his tent, like, Saladin's that are, like, stuck there with poison daggers.
There's plenty of derring do that's happening in tents in Syria.
Yes, exactly. And we get more and more mythology as well, like, built up around some of the people of this movement as well, so... Loads and loads of myths about these guys that can just, like, melt into shadows and transmogrify themselves into toads and stuff like that.
Whereas mostly they just dress up as nuns.
Yeah, they dress up. There's ones they dress up as nuns or Christians or, like, and, you know, a lot of the time they'll kill some. I mean, they have, like, a good hit rate, but that's because a lot of the time they'll just get killed right afterwards.
Yeah.
Or they'll kill themselves to avoid getting, like, tortured afterwards. But it's still all very mysterious and obviously provides a very... good environment for myth and legend to flourish. And so according to legend, actually, Saladin is like so vexed and perplexed by all of these attempts, and in particular has like so much respect for Al-Dinan, who is
he's the guy in Syria.
For Rashid al-Din Sinan, who is the successor to Hassan II, and who becomes, like, one of the most famed and mysterious figures, and apparently, you know, according to legend, Saladin is just, like, so impressed by this guy's swag that he's like, there's no way I'll be able to beat him. So we have to form an alliance, and so they form kind of a tentative alliance, which leads to the first assassinations by the assassins of Westerners as well. So now all of a sudden you've got, yeah, Europeans getting, like, stabbed to death in the courts. You've got people, you know, posing as bodyguards and posing as soldiers as well, and then they'll just, like, jump out at you and stab you as soon as you get close. So it's, you know, something that doesn't happen all that often, but becomes, you know, a source of fear. And is very successful at striking fear into the crusaders' hearts.
Yes, and this is the point at which Europeans start writing about the assassins. So the oldest account of the assassins is that of Benjamin of Tudela, who is a Jewish traveler who ends up in the Levant in 1167. And he writes the sort of the first Western account of the assassins. Now he gets some pretty basic stuff wrong. That I think is quite fun. So he claims they don't believe in Islam, and he thinks they live in Lebanon, because he's mistranslated the Arabic word for heretics and thinks that it's a place. But he's wrong in ways that are interesting, because it's very clear that he's getting his information about the assassins from Sunni sources based on the way that he describes them. Especially the stuff about, yeah, these guys aren't Muslims. Even though that is not how they would ever consider themselves.
Yeah.
But it's not like he can talk to these guys.
No.
And then, of course, the most famous person to write about the assassins is Marco Polo. Well, Marco Polo and his ghostwriter.
Yep.
Okay, we cannot truly do justice to the sheer interesting weirdness of Marco Polo and his book. So we're just going to have to talk about this a little bit, because I think this is the sort of canonical Western interpretation of the assassins at the time. Now, Marco Polo, very importantly, never met any assassins. He was traveling in Asia long after they had ceased operations. However, he does apparently, according to the travels of Marco Polo, he does apparently hear whilst in Asia about these guys. Now, we have some reasons to doubt based on the kind of things that he does say and the stuff that he gets wrong. He gets stuff wrong in a pattern, essentially, that's a consistent pattern that suggests that he is getting stuff not from Middle Eastern sources, but from previous kind of European writings about it. And the whole, oh, Marco heard of this whilst traveling in the East is just a kind of framing device and not true.
It's very Prester John, isn't it?
It's Prester John.
I went to India and Prester John was right around the corner, but my boat was leaving, so I didn't have time to go see him.
So I'm going to read little bits of Marco Polo's narrative, and we can kind of do a little bit of a close reading about what fits with what we already know and what is where there are potentially in European inventions. So, in the chapter titled "The Old Man at the Mountain." Because he's first of all, the title "The Old Man of the Mountain" is sort of commonly associated with the leader of the assassins. This is a mistranslation of the word "sheikh." It should mean "lord." He's saying "old man" instead. So the old man was called in their language Aladdin. He had caused a certain valley between two mountains to be enclosed and had turned it into a garden. See, I told you we were going to get back to gardens.
And they do apparently have really nice gardens in their castles.
So that's tick. Okay, we've got. So far, we're not doing too bad. The largest and most beautiful that had ever been seen, filled with every variety of fruit. In it were erected pavilions and palaces, the most elegant that can be imagined, all covered with gilding and exquisite painting. And there were runnels, too, flowing freely with wine and milk and honey and water, and numbers of ladies and the most beautiful damsels in the world, who could play on all manner of instruments and sung most sweetly. Okay. Those who listened to the previous episode are probably noticing some stuff. So where did all these baddies come from? That's my question. You live on the fucking top of a mountain. Do you think you have a lot of money to sustain an entire population of effete ladies of the court who are running around presumably naked, bathing in honey and milk and things.
Exactly. It's like, oh, they're really sexy as long as you don't look below their ankles, because their feet are super fucked up. Yeah. They've got all these calluses from, like, the Rocky Mountain roads.
Yeah, they live on the
side. Running around barefoot.
They're like haggises, because they live on the side of a mountain.
Yeah, exactly. One leg is shorter than the other. One boob is, like, bigger than the other to counterbalance, you know? No, just kidding. Everyone's has one boob that's bigger than the other, and that's just how it is.
Nice.
Sorry. Yes. Asymmetry.
I had to do the stoppage voice. For the old man desired to make his people believe that this was actually paradise. So he had fashioned it after the description that Muhammad gave of his paradise, to wit, that it should be a beautiful garden running with conduits of wine and milk and honey and water and full of lovely women for the delectation of all its inmates. And sure enough, the Saracens, this is European for Muslim, basically, of these parts believed that it was paradise. So again, open question of, this is obviously not true, but is this a tall tale that was told about the assassin strongholds, or was it a European kind of invention? I suspect it was probably a bit of both.
Yeah.
Because I imagine if you're like a Syrian guy and you can see this castle that you can't get into on the next hill, and he's like, I bet they got loads of cool shit in there.
Yeah.
And hot women. But potentially, as I think we'll see, I think the hot women maybe a European innovation.
And there are, you know, kind of echoes of the whole apocalyptic ideology, you know, the idea of an earthly paradise, which is something that, you know, would have, other Muslims would have been aware of and I think ostensibly could have been sort of twisted around by Sunnis into something that is, like, you know, even more heretical than it actually was.
Yes. Now, no man was allowed to enter the garden save those who he intended to be his ashasim. There was a fortress at the entrance to the garden strong enough to resist all the world, and there was no other way to get in. So again, we got correct mountain fortress, tick. He kept at his court a number of youths of the country from 12 to 20 years of age, such as had a taste for soldiering, and those he used to tell tall tales about paradise, just as Muhammad had been wont to do, and they believed him just as the Saracens believe in Muhammad. So again, this is a little bit of a dig at, can you believe these Muslims believe in heaven? We would never we would never believe in anything so foolish, even though we were Christians, we believe all the same shit.
Yep. Yeah, we don't believe in Muslim heaven.
We believe in real heaven.
Yeah, like, imagine how stupid it would be if I believed in a heaven where everyone was Muslim.
Yeah. Then, so, okay, this is where it gets interesting. Then he would induce them into his garden, some 4, 6, or 10 at a time, having first made them drink a certain potion which cast them into a deep sleep, and then causing them to be lifted and carried in. So when they awoke, they found themselves in the garden. So basically, what he's saying is, he would take kind of some of his followers, drug them, dump them in this garden full of baddies, and they would wake up and go, "Nice,"
and they would believe that they had died and gone to heaven.
Yes, and when therefore they awoke and found themselves in a place so charming, they deemed that it was paradise in very truth. And the ladies and damsels dallied with them to their heart's content, so that they had what young men would have. And with their own good will, they never would have quitted the place. So again, this is the part that is definitively does not show up in any Western accounts before Marco Polo. Marco Polo has made this sexy.
Yep.
There are women. Previously, there are women, but there's no sort of indication that they're like, you're going to go and sleep with all of them.
Nope.
And this is, again, I think it's too early to call this Orientalism properly, but this is, like, the idea that the Middle East is full of, like, beautiful, sexually available women who will just sort of fall on you is, it starts pretty early.
Yes, exactly. And it's, you know, he has a story to tell and a story to sell. He wants this to be compelling, and he wants it to buy into people's, you know, stereotypes of what that area is like. And, you know, I mean, the idea of barbarism being tied to, like, sexual licentiousness is also an extremely old one. It's even older than Christianity, you know. It's, you know, also extremely common in ancient Roman writings to say, oh, and then we went to France and all the women were total slags or whatever, you know. It's a common way of you know, sort of othering people in a way that's also, like, very gratifying to the reader. Because, of course, the reader is going to read that and be like,
that would be awesome if that happened.
They're going to be like, no, well, they're going to be like, that's what, how that's disgusting.
But also, interesting.
Yeah, you know, it's, I mean, it's like all voyeurism, basically.
Yes. And I would also say that I say that this is probably just proto-Orientalism, but also there is a part of me that thinks, is he working here from a Sunni or other Shia slur that just says, oh yeah, they're all just like slagging it up there.
Yeah, I think you have to say that there was influence from other, like, Muslim sects in shaping this view that they had of them, because there are, you know, I think that's the thing you have to reckon with, is that there are elements of truth in that a lot of the assassin mission was about self-sacrifice in, you know, the name of, you know, glory, and in, you know, going to heaven, going to the afterlife, serving, you know, Allah, serving God, doing what is, like, mandated to you by God. So it's, you know, it's like a extremely garbled and, yeah, orientalized view of this, but I think there are, you know, strains of truth.
Once they've had a little bit of the sort of taste of paradise and gone, nice, he'll sort of take them back, he'll drug them again, take them back and say, see, I can put you in paradise at any time. Now go and kill yourselves, and you'll get to live there forever. And, of course, they go off and do that. There's also, by the way, this is not in that version of Marco Polo's story. But there's also an idea that gets started around this time of a tall tale about the Iman meets with somebody, and to demonstrate the loyalty of his followers, he orders them some of them to just jump off of the castle walls, and they just do it. This seems to be a mistranslation as well.
Huh?
Because there's an earlier Christian account where they're like, yes, and then the followers of the assassin leader threw themselves down before him and frustrated themselves, which seems to have then been rendered as they threw themselves down a pit.
Maybe they threw themselves down to prostrate themselves, not seeing the cliff that was right in front of them.
And I think that there's a real cynicism in Marco Polo's account where he's basically saying, like, we had fun at the idea. Imagine heaven. How silly is that idea? But, like, there is a thread running through this of, like, Marco Polo clearly thinks that even by the standards of Muslims, this guy is kind of a sham. And there is a very cynical way. I mean, before we started recording this, Olivia, you referred to the assassins as almost like a cult. In a kind of recognizably modern style where it's like, seclude yourself from the sort of wider world. I have secret knowledge. Only I can help you achieve spiritual enlightenment. By the way, now you have to kill yourself.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's yeah, exactly.
And there, yeah, I mean, I think that part of one of the questions that we wanted to explore with this episode was, like, why are they like this, basically? And I think that I don't necessarily agree with the Marco Polo-ite kind of analysis that this guy's a fraud. Because I think there's so much of this story is about deep sincerity. But I do think that the psychological dynamic of a modern-day cult is absolutely at play here. And I think that you can definitely read the ritual where they kind of break Sharia as a kind of, like, crossing of a... getting your followers to cross the Rubicon with you.
Yes.
Which a lot of cults kind of do. They make you sort of profane yourself in a way that makes it impossible for you to go back to normal society.
Yeah.
Or at least feel like you can't.
Yeah. Exactly. I think that's a really good point. And I think it's in some ways the only logical response to a world, you know, to the inherent conflict between an ideology that demands you to have this sole faith in this sole authority figure who is the sole link between you and God versus, you know, again, the machinations of the world, the scheming viziers and the difficult questions that get asked. Because it all seems so simple on paper, this degree of orthodoxy that, you know, the Ismaili doctrine demands of you. But then it becomes really difficult to actually reckon with real world dilemmas and issues. Like, what if someone offs the imam?
Now, I want to make something incredibly important, or make an incredibly important point. Nizari Ismailism is a real living religion. I am not calling it a cult. What I am saying is that the specific dynamics and specific choices made by specific leaders at a specific time certainly appear to have been quite effective at cultivating a kind of cult-like atmosphere within these very enclosed environments of these castles.
Well, yeah, because now Nizari Ismaili Shia Muslims are like one of the most sort of widely distributed, least isolated groups of people in Islam. So yeah, I mean, that's obviously
they're not all living in castles anymore.
Unfortunately, they're not all living in castles. Aga Khan probably is. But yeah, this is purely about the assassins and about sort of, you know, and about maintaining this extremely doctrinal, orthodox lifestyle and just system of beliefs.
So all of this interesting stuff has been happening in the Middle East and in Persia, and lots of complicated webs of alliances and this whole network of interesting people having lots of ideas and killing each other. That is all going to get upended by a bunch of people who've been doing something entirely unrelated for this whole time, which is the arrival of the Mongols in the early 13th century. So, meanwhile, in the Central Asian steppe, in the early 1200s, there's a local Mongol chief named Tejimin unites the Mongol clans, sorry, the Mongol tribes of the Central Asian steppe, and in 1206, has himself declared as Genghis Khan. What does Genghis Khan mean? Nobody knows. Moving on.
I thought it meant cool dude.
I mean, yeah, basically. I mean, the consensus seems to be he gave himself a cool name to make him to make some kind of point. You may see it rendered as universal leader or universal Khan. It doesn't seem to have an easy direct translation. Anyway, so Genghis, like all Mongol rulers, depended on the circulation of trade to raise revenues and to reward his followers. And Iran, in particular, or Persia, as we've been calling it, is an essential step on the southern land route between India and Europe. Because remember, this is a world where there is this kind of barrier between the Christian world and the rest of Asia, which is the Muslim world, but it's a permeable barrier. There's still trade happening. So possibly because of the absolutely bird-brained leadership of Khwarezmid Empire in massacring some Mongol merchants in 1218, Genghis sort of has a pretext to invade and sort of subjugate Iran and bring it into his imperial domain. And the Mongol invasion of Persia, it's enormously bloody. Hundreds of thousands of people, conservatively, are killed in just a few years. And it ends with the annexation of most of Persia into the Mongol Empire. However, Genghis Khan does not target the lands of the assassins. This may be, and this is very contentious, this may be because there was some kind of alliance between the assassins and the Mongols, which kind of, again, if we think about how the assassins have been conducting themselves politically, makes a great deal of sense. The Mongols do not give a fuck about, the Mongols are so committed to religious tolerance, it never really occurs to them that they need to have a justification for it.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, if you want to be a bunch of weird kind of Muslims living in the hills, doing your own thing, the Khan truly does not care as long as the gold is flowing.
Yeah, which is not historically a very, like, you know, singular position to take. That was also, like, the Romans, you know, well, you worship your gods, but it's probably basically the same as what we do.
Yeah. And so in 1221, the Nizari Iman sends an embassy to the great Khan in Karakorum to pay homage. So essentially offer themselves up as vassals of the great Khan, as basically everybody who in the region who is quickly realizing that these guys are not going away and also you're not going to be able to beat them is doing. And in the lifetime of Genghis Khan, again, you can debate about whether or not there was a premeditated alliance between the Mongols and the assassins. Either way, it seems like in Genghis Khan's life, the relationship seems to have been quite good and quite peaceful. Because again, having the sort of local liege lord be somebody who does not really engage in any of the, like, spiritual debates that the assassins have generally been on the wrong end of is quite helpful. But in 1229, Genghis Khan dies, and he is succeeded by his son Ogedei, who is eventually succeeded by Genghis's grandson Munkay Khan in 1241. And at some point in that kind of window, things have gone sideways in the Mongol assassin relationship. Again, when did a breach happen? We don't really know. it might just be that because when the Khwarezids sort of are out of the picture, the Mongols and the Assassins start looking at each other not as sort of allies of convenience, but as people who could do real damage to each other. You might be wondering, well, what are the Mongols going to do to the Assassins? The Assassins are up on castles in the sky, and the Mongols are a bunch of horse archers, to which I would say the Mongols are also ferociously effective siege warriors. They have been learning from all of the great sort of siege engineers of Persia and China for a generation. Do not fuck with them, as we will see.
Yeah, and they have a very cosmopolitan empire. I mean, they've got like French people in there hanging out. Like, you know, they're not quite as parochial as people sometimes believe that they are.
Good God, no. Oh my God. No, they encompass pretty much every type of person that you can find in Eurasia at this point. And so in 1258, William, the Flemish priest William of Rubuk, who is sort of visiting the Mongol capital of Karakorum, says that there is increased security on foreigners in the city because there was an assassination attempt against Monke Khan. Whether or not this is actually true, and whether or not he is just reporting what is sort of the rumors that are swirling in the city, because historically, Mongols don't like being upfront with foreigners about their internal politics, and it's great sport for a Mongol to just like lie to these guys, because again, it is quite politically useful.
Oh yeah, and it's not like guessing. William speaks Mongolian, you know. Exactly. Because his travel logs are really funny, because it's mostly about him having like no luck finding a good translator until he meets a random French guy who's like, yeah, I'll sort you out. But like, it's mostly him being like, and then my translator, who you know, was a random Tajik guy that took my money and gave me a sheep and said, isn't this the same thing? And then I found out he stole the sheep and then he disappeared.
Yeah.
And that's the only guy I had to translate my words to the Khan, who then tried to kill me because he thought I had said something really fucked up.
He's trying to swindle me. Have this man killed. No,
literally, there's like an episode where his translator like gets drunk and is like drunkenly translating between him and the Khan, who is also drunk. And he's like, and the Khan is getting like more and more angry. He's like, Khan, I have brought you like something more precious than gold. And the Khan is like, you think I'm broke? It's so funny. Anyways.
So, allegedly, in response to this attack, which again has happened at some point leading up to the 1250s, Monke Khan orders his brother Hugilu Khan to wipe the assassins off the map. The direct quote is, "Kill them all." So there's an initial phase of Mongol attacks on the Assassins' fortresses between 1253 and 1256 that kind of have mixed results. Some castles surrender, others repel the Mongols. The campaign isn't really going anywhere until Hugilu himself kind of crosses the sort of boundary into Persia and with a large army and starts directing the war himself. So at this point, the Iman is a 26-year-old guy, by the way, by the name of Imam Qurashah, who writes to Hugilu offering to negotiate some sort of surrender, to which Hugilu accepts but doesn't pause the fighting. He basically says, if you want us to actually stop our campaign, you have to go and pay homage to the great Khan himself, who, again, is hundreds of miles away in China at this point. So the Imam sort of orders a surrender, but a lot of the assassin fortresses hold out, which is that is such a detail. We don't have, but that fact is incredibly interesting.
Yeah.
Because this is the infallible spiritual leader of your cult. And he's like, hey guys, maybe we need to maybe we need to call quits on this.
Yep.
And some people are kind of too deep in the sauce to... I mean, like, there are people who've been trained in many cases to, like, accept their own deaths as inevitable. Like, not that crazy, I guess?
No, I don't think so.
So anyway, so goes to meet Monkey Khan and sort of submits the assassin order and sort of agrees to surrender and agrees to have the castle at Alamut demolished, actually. After kind of agreeing this on the way back from Karakoram, the Aman is executed. And that's kind of the end of the assassin order as an organized kind of force in the region. I mean, there are specific fortresses that hold out for longer. There are kind of roving assassins that are still at large in somewhere in the Middle East. But this is the end of the old man in the mountain and the whole world that we have kind of been following in this story. And we have a sort of sense, almost an epitaph for the assassin order from a Persian chronicler called Juvani, who was the chronicler for Hugilu Khan after he kind of ascends to the Khanate of Persia. So was the world cleansed which had been polluted by their evil. Wayfarers now ply to and fro without fear or dread or the inconvenience of paying a toll, and pray for the fortune of the happy king who uprooted their foundations and left no trace of any one of them. Let those who shall come after this age and era know the extent of the mischief they wrought and the confusion they cast into the hearts of men. Such as were on terms of agreement with them, whether kings of former times or contemporary rulers, went in fear and trembling. It was a cup that had been filled to overflowing. It seems as a wind that had died.
Aw, that's beautiful.
It is. That is the problem with Persian writing, is even when they're being, even when he's being incredibly damning,
yes,
it's still beautiful and, like, quite moving.
Yeah. It's like, oh, they were just mischievous guys.
And also, like, I love the phrase of it seems as a wind that had died.
Yeah.
And that is the end of the assassins. I mean, they've obviously lived on in popular culture, in the English language.
Yes.
I mean, like I said, they became a verb, which is always very impressive to get to do. And I think what they have kind of contributed to is the exoticization of the Middle East and of the Islamic early early 13th century, when the Middle East and parts of Europe are kind of brought into this sort of world economic system across all of Eurasia that the Mongols are running and running quite profitably, it's more information is kind of coming out into Europe about the Middle East, about Islam, and the idea of these sort of esoteric lunatics living at the top of mountains, you know, throwing themselves off cliffs to prove some esoteric point, chimes with a lot of the stuff that Westerners want to and have always wanted to believe about Islam and believe about the Middle East as a whole.
And we can't fault them for that. I mean, they were just doing their own thing. It was really the people who came and saw them and, you know, or heard a story about a story about a story about them and, you know, sort of spun it. I think people, at the end of the day, I think you have to bear in mind that they're, you know, it was deeply ideological, this movement, but it was also political and it was about power as much as it was about niche esoteric divinity and theology. And it was a symptom of this incredibly fragmented, you know, fledgling world. I mean, what's his name? Hodgson says that at this point, the Islamic world is old enough to have, you know, forwards momentum, but not so old that it feels the weight of history bearing down upon it. So it is, you know, I think part of this tradition of people, you know, religions, defining themselves in completely unprecedented ways that now seem somewhat unthinkable, but during these sort of primordial embryonic times, is really just part of the story of how you know, we arrived at the current status quo.
I do want to return us to this idea of the Mongol world system and of the Mongols changing the course of kind of how Europe and Asia relate to one another, because that is going to be the subject of the next episode, where we're going to talk about the role of the Mongol Empire, and particularly the Golden Horde, in late medieval history, and particularly ask the question that is sort of, I see posited quite often on social media, of like, wait a minute, there was a transcontinental empire in the Middle Ages, why isn't there more of a cultural legacy for it? To which I am going to say, oh boy, just you wait. Spoiler alert, it's not just dumplings. Although it also is that.
Yes, and after that, we'll get into why fish think there's no cultural legacy of water.
Imagine, if you will, a world in which Russia does not exist. But yeah, no, I'm looking forward to that episode, and if you enjoyed this episode and you want to see more of this show, then please do leave us a 5-star review on your podcast platform of choice. And also, if you like, you can leave a Spotify comment, and Olivia might read it out on the show.
I just wanted to give a general roundup, because in the last episode, yes, we asked you guys to say what kind of drunkard you were, of the 12 types of drunkard, and I think Hungry Horse is the leader by quite a bit.
Yes.
So yeah, very real of you guys.
And by the way, in the interest of transparency, yes, you, me, and Joe Mason went to an ale festival in Italy, which was maybe the most medieval thing any of us have ever done.
And I think we all became quite hungry horses by the end.
There was no amount of scampi fries that could have sated me.
Oh my god, I forgot about the scampi fries. Yeah. Not huzzah. Last night, but a different night. In fact, I one time when I was out, I bought a packet of scampi fries for the table and another packet for me to keep in my pocket and eat furtively, which I think is actually pretty democratic.
You're such a Judas.
That's right. Thanks to Carlos Funk, who mentioned another region associated with mead is the East Slavic lands. One of the four spouts on the silver tree of Karakorum sprayed mead to represent the Rus' principalities of the Golden Horde. So, yeah, more on that type of thing when we talk about the Mongols.
Oh my god, I can't wait to talk about fermented horse milk.
Oh, yeah, because that was the French the French guy that William of Rubruck meets is the guy who builds that tree.
No shit!
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, no, the fermented horse milk. They ate so much meat. They just all, so many cons just got gout.
I know, and it's so funny reading about, like, the Europeans in Karakorum that have been, like, abducted and, like, probably, like, experienced extreme hardship, but then, like, somehow it's come to light that they have useful skills, so it's just like, well, I'm a silversmith, I'm very well paid, I'm well taken care of, I have a really nice yurt. No, I can't leave, but, you know, my son is bilingual, so that's cool.
he'll be very employable.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, no, until next time, take it easy.
Abash.
That your official sign-off?
Yeah.